The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, in 1948, Palestinians were subjected to what became known as the Nakba, the violent displacement of Palestinians and dispossession of their lands and belongings. Today, we're witnessing the second Nakba. That's according to opinion writer and author Fintan Drury. In his new book, Catastrophe, Nakba 2, he takes us through the psyche and the history of Israeli attitudes towards the Palestinian people and the oppression of their society right up to the present day as their war with Hamas continues. And Fintan is with me now. Fintan Drury, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Pat. Good morning.
Now, let's talk about the Nakba first. The first Nakba, 1948. The second Nakba, you believe, is happening right now, before our eyes.
Yes, and it goes back, the issue really goes back all the way to when Britain handed over the territories to the Zionist movement and was warned. This goes back to the Balfour Agreement of 1918, and the British government made a decision that they would effectively hand over land that was controlled under the British mandate.
Now let's describe what the population of the area was like. There were Jewish people living there, but not many.
About 6% of the population at that time was.
And where
was
did
Jewish.
The push for this homeland
it
come
came,
from?
It came ultimately, or initially, from a man called Theodor Herzl, who was a Jewish philosopher, lived in the previous century, and wrote that the land of Palestine should be taken for the Jewish people and it should become the nation state of the Jewish people. And he did say an interesting thing at that time when he wrote about it in his diaries. He talked about the need for this to be done by stealth and that it would have to be done very carefully in order that the local population, the Arab population, would not be incited.
Now, you have a quotation from him from 1896 where he said, "We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries while denying it employment in our country. The process of expropriation and removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly."
Exactly. And when that proved not to be possible in 1948, the first Nakba happened. And then I think a pivotal point was in 1967, at the end of the Six-Day War. And I quote in the book a statement made by Charles de Gaulle, the then French president, who warned that the failure to resolve this issue at that time, after the Six-Day War, which led to revised boundaries for the state of Israel and reduced boundaries for the state of Israel, which Israel since has refused to recognize. Therefore, we have the occupied territories. But de Gaulle warned at that time that the displacement of the Palestinian people would inevitably lead to them feeling oppressed, even more oppressed, and if the oppression continued, then there would be a reaction.
Now, there's no doubt that Netanyahu, his line of thought is directly going back to the Zionist movement of the late 19th century. He said in 2022, "The Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right to all the areas of the land of Israel, Galilee, the Negev, Golan, Judea, and Samaria."
And for those who argue that the Herzl ambition, the Zionist ambition, has somehow, you know, disappeared, it's no longer a driver within the Israeli political machinations, they need to recognize that when the State of Israel was founded, on the day that it was founded, Herzl was the one figure who was deified on that occasion. And there was a large image of him behind the platform where the state was launched, if you like, or announced formally in Israel. And also there is a public holiday in Israel every year. It's Herzl Day.
Now, going back to the Balfour Declaration and the decision that this would become, whatever its dimensions at the time, a Jewish homeland, with only 6% of the population there, were there any voices saying, hang on a second, this is a bit ridiculous. 6% of the people are going to have to displace a number of the Palestinian natives who've lived there for generations. Any voices saying, no, stop.
And by the time of the Nakba, the first Nakba, the population was 33%. The Jewish percentage of the population was around 33%. But the voice that was most important, and to me is the one that I refer back to in the book, is Edwin Montagu, who wrote a memo at the time to the Prime Minister of Britain saying, you know, that the Balfour Agreement was a massive, massive error of judgment. He said Zionism is a mischievous political creed, and he warned that Arabs in Palestine would be regarded as foreigners in their own land, in the same way, he said, as Jews, if we agree to this, Jews will, you know, if you create a Jewish homeland, Jews in every other country will be regarded as foreigners as a result of this. And he was only Jewish member of that cabinet.
He was Jewish, and he warned that because it was almost an invitation to anti-Semitism in other countries. You are not of us.
That's what
your country is off there in the Middle East. Off you go.
That's what he said would happen.
And he said
nations would, other nations would be justified in saying, what are you doing here?
Now, your book, obviously, people will say, like they say about any critique of the Israeli state as distinct from the Jewish people, they will say is anti-Semitic. What do you say to that charge?
Well, the Universal Declaration on anti-Semitism that was signed by 350 Jewish academics and thought leaders around the world was published in 2020. And it talks about the different aspects to anti-Semitism and the fact that it is a form of racism, which it is. But in that declaration, they spell out very clearly that to criticize the state of Israel is not anti-Semitic.
For the state of Israel is such a uniquely important cause that it is reasonable to brand those opposed to its unlawful expansion as such. They believe that Israel is a state with rights above the international norm. In other words, they believe they're special.
Well, they believe they're special, and clearly they have, you know, ignored UN resolution after UN resolution. They are occupying. I mean, we are horrified. Most people are horrified by what we've witnessed in Gaza over the last 20 months. But I went to the West Bank last summer and witnessed what's been happening there firsthand. I witnessed that and could not believe the extent to which, as this war is going on in Gaza, and it's not really a war, but this conflict is going on in Gaza and being played out in front of us, behind that veil, the accretion of land, the theft of land by the state of Israel in the West Bank has accelerated beyond our worst imaginings. And, you know, I spent a number of days with a family, the Treish family in Ramallah. The father's an engineer, speaks fluent English, fluent Arabic, fluent Hebrew, lived there all his life, and his land has been taken, and he is fighting it in the courts. I saw wonderful, beautiful new roads built from Ramallah to Jerusalem, but they are only that you can only use them if you're a Jew.
If you're a settler. Or if you're coming to visit settlers.
Yeah, and I deliberately in the book use settler in parentheses. I mean, to me, they're thieves. Language is important here. About, you know, there's a question about war. We all use it naturally, in a sense, but it's not an accurate
description. But the Israeli state has no right to these lands that it's taking.
Zip. None.
Now, you also contend it's very interesting that the Netanyahu government before was funneling money to Hamas.
Oh,
this is extraordinary. It wasn't something that I was aware of, and perhaps I should have been, that they were sending money to Hamas in Gaza to thwart the effectiveness of Fatah, who were running the West Bank, because they believed that the possibility of a separate Palestinian state would be located really on the West Bank, whatever about Gaza, and that they could not allow to happen. So they were supporting Hamas to undermine Fatah.
Hundreds of millions of dollars in cash through Qatar to Hamas because they regarded Hamas as a safer bet than Fatah.
Now, the successor at that time, when he took power, he said, the suitcases of cash have got to stop.
I mean, he's now in opposition to Netanyahu, but he was a member of the government that facilitated those payments. And so, you know, there's just to describe as hollow the criticisms and the allegations that are made against Hamas by Netanyahu et al. Is, you know, an understatement.
Now, when we discuss this current version of a Middle East war, and there have been so many of them, it always goes back to just one date, the 7th of October. And you have a whole section in your book, what the situation was like the day before. I think it's on page 53. The day before, Friday, 6th of October, Israel controlled most of Palestine in complete defiance of international law. Israel kept the people of Gaza under a blockade. Palestinians were without electricity for an average of 13 hours a day. More than 96% of the groundwater in Gaza was considered unfit for human consumption. And you have all references here that back up these contentions. It's not talking off the top of your head. Israel controlled the supply of food and other critical supplies, meaning before the Hamas attack, 80% of the population of Gaza relied on humanitarian aid. Most of Gaza's population could not travel into Israel. They could only get into the West Bank via Israel because, as we know, the Gaza Strip is isolated completely from the West Bank. And it goes on, the settlements continued. You've got so many, and they sound a bit like justifications for October the 7th.
Well, they're explaining what the situation was on October the 6th, because one of the reasons I wrote the book was I became very irked by the fact that everybody referenced October the 7th as if it had just, you know, this group of Hamas and fighters had scaled the walls, literally and metaphorically, of the state of Israel and gone in and decided to kill people with, you know, that there was no cause. But it goes back to De Gaulle. It goes back to if you oppress people. And De Gaulle wasn't the only one who said it, by the way. I mean, John F. Kennedy, who's much loved still on this island, John F. Kennedy wrote to his father. It's in the Kennedy archive. He wrote to his father and said, this all goes back to, you know, the poor Palestinians. This all goes back to the Brits. And he said, you know, the British gave the land of Palestine to the Jewish people as if it was theirs to give.
That's what John F. Kennedy said, as if it were theirs to give. Now, it's interesting. You're right. When the history of this period is written, it is the United States of America on whom, out of all Israel's allies, the burden of guilt will rest. The U.S. allowed itself to become Netanyahu's lapdog. And Robert Fisk, you quote from him, his wonderful last book, the craven genuflection of the American elite towards Israel is as shameful as it is unworthy of a great nation, an alliance of strength and cowardice. Israeli policy is now U.S. policy.
And elsewhere in that book, and you and I both knew him, he talks about the attack in 2021, which was a short-lived attack, and the ratio of deaths was like a couple of hundred Israelis had been killed, and 1,100 or 1,400 Palestinians had been killed. And he talked about, you know, that Hamas had a responsibility, but that the disproportionate reaction of Israel to what had happened, the incident that had sparked that reaction, was, you know, mind-boggling to him. And I write in the book that what would that, you know, wonderful, wonderful journalist and writer on the Middle East, the man who, in my opinion, knew more about it, understood it more, had a greater empathy than anyone else who you know, from the West, who wrote about it, what would he talks in Night of Power, that final book, about disproportionate response. What would he make of this?
He would be in despair, I suspect.
He would be in despair.
Going back to October the 7th, it need not have happened. I mean, this is not in any way to justify anything that was done on that day, the kidnapping of ordinary civilians, the killing of 1,200 people. I mean, if you look at proportionate killing, if you like, in Ireland, that would have meant the killing of about 800 people in proportion to the population. And how would we have reacted if a bunch of people from Northern Ireland rocked down and kidnapped people and killed people in that number? I mean, we would have been incensed. So you can understand how the Israelis were incensed by that. But it need not have happened. They took their eye off the ball, and there were some female lookouts that the IDF chose not to believe. Was that misogyny?
Well, I mean, they had warnings from Egypt, which are documented, and I document in the book. They had warnings from the United States And they had very specific warnings from a group of intelligence officers, who happened to be all female unit. Not only did they tell them that there was an attack coming, they described the attack. They described the nature of the attack, including things like ladders being used to scale fences, including part of the attack being done by drones, and also people coming in to the State of Israel on paragliders. All of that was documented, and it is referenced in various places. There are various sources that stand it up, if you like, but they also point to the fact that the women officers, after the event, said they believe that one of the reasons the advice was ignored was because there were women.
So Netanyahu and his intelligence services should have anticipated this attack and prepared for it, but they did not. Now, you don't blame people for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but the government of Israel could have protected those people.
Could have, should have. Maybe they had a sense that something was coming. I mean, we also have to look at the political backdrop here. Netanyahu was a man under immense pressure internally within Israel. He's 75 years of age. I say that is not the reason why this is his last go as prime minister. He's facing, or was then facing, three criminal trials. He's still facing two, one of which looks like it is really, really serious. There is a person in the Israeli political system, the current attorney general, who is refusing to have that trial pushed back and is insisting that that trial would advance. It's a woman, and she is part of his administration, and he has tried to oust her, but oust her he cannot do so far. And ultimately, his political future is on the line here. So I'm not the first person to say this. It's been widely reported that there is a sense that the war, as it has been described, that this conflict is something that suits him politically.
Now that's been said on this program many times, okay, that, you know, the idea of a permanent ceasefire doesn't suit him because that brings back political stability, yeah, and therefore the rule of law and all of those, yeah, processes, mm-hmm, will continue. So as long as there's conflict, he is politically safe.
Correct.
And free from the attentions of the courts.
Yeah, and I think we can sort of say, well, look, you know, nobody in political power is going to be that base in terms of their management of their own interests. I think this man is in a special place, has a special status.
Now, you have to though point the finger to the people in Hamas who contrived this attack. They know from their history of conflict in the Middle East how disproportionate Israeli responses normally are. So they must have known what they were bringing down on the people of Gaza. They must have known that it would be terrible, maybe not as terrible as it has turned out to be, but they must have known there would be a ferocious response. And were they hoping that the nature of that response would be such that the Iranians would get more actively involved, that neighbouring states would be so appalled that they couldn't stand idly by and watch the Palestinian people being crucified?
Well, I don't know, but my suspicion is that, you're not wrong in profiling it in that manner and asking that question, but I think they would have more thought about what the West might do. And they may have thought that the United States would intervene and actually, you know, if it got completely out of control, not initially, but completely out of control, as it has done. I think if you were to get the view of people within Hamas, they are probably astounded by the fact that Israel can inflict this level of damage and move on now from the bombardment to continuing some of the sort of military warfare, but in parallel with that, introduce a strategically managed and deliberately managed and staged conditions where famine is now going to kill the population. And so I think that, you know, the Iranian threat is overplayed, in my opinion. I reported for RTE back in the 80s from Libya and said then that I thought that the West didn't really appreciate and understand the Arab world, that there's a complexity there that we have never, ever really understood, and we're not prepared to acknowledge that there's a culture which is very different to ours. It's as rich as ours. It's different and it's not at all threatening. But the Israelis have used the Iranian threat really, really, really successfully. We are the last vestige. We are the bulwark against the threat of Iran in this part of the world, and therefore across the world, if you include nuclear power.
Well, we've only skimmed the surface of the book. It's called Catastrophe, which it definitely is unfolding in Gaza, subtitled Nakba 2. It's written by Fintan Drury, and it is available everywhere now, published by Merriam Press. Fintan Drury, thank you very much for joining us in studio.
Thank you, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.